Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, writer-director Rebecca Hall discusses her recent Netflix film, Passing, with Northwestern University professor Dr. Ivy Wilson. This conversation originally took place October 21st, 2021, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. Quick programming note, we enter this conversation in progress. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
I now know, after 13 years of my journey with the book, because I finished the book and immediately started writing the adaptation. I mean, really, actually, I shut the book and then the laptop came open, and because it was sort of like it was an intense experience for me. I couldn't stop myself. But in the 13 years of that and developing the script, having the nerve to show it to people, having the nerve to sort of stand up and say, yes, this is the first movie that I want to make in this very precise, ambitious way, also paralleled my uncovering of any remaining mysteries around my family. I now know that my grandfather did indeed pass white for his entire life. He also passed Native American. It's a fascinating story. Both of his parents were black. His father was a man called John Williams, who turns out to have been a race man. He was born enslaved, and then he went to Washington. He got a job in government. He knew Frederick Douglass. In fact, he toasted him at an event at the White House. I mean, I'm only saying this because, you know, all histories are extraordinary. I'm not saying because mine happens to have some of these elements of huge sort of touchstones of American history makes it particularly special, but the point is, it was a race. My mother didn't know this, and now she does.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit about, you said that when you finish reading the novel, you immediately opened up the laptop, and I just want to hear a little bit more about the kind of tactility of that, the sensuality of holding a book in the hand, and then moving to a different technology, that is the kind of typewriter, to translate that emotion. And I'm trying to give a word to that emotion, and I'm inviting you to help me think about the word that immediately comes to mind is catharsis, but I'm not quite sure if there was a thing you were trying to reconcile before, if you didn't know.
No, you're right. I don't know how to, it was a bit like a catharsis, more like when you need to throw up. You know, I couldn't, I think the use of the word sensuality is interesting because it was a sort of, it was a tactile experience, and the simplest way to put it is I got to about page 10, the scene where they're, I don't know if it is page 10, but roughly in that area, the scene where they meet in the tea room in the Drayton Hotel, and I'm suddenly seeing it in black and white. I'm suddenly seeing it in 4:3. I'm like, well, this is about categories, so they have to be constrained. I literally want to put them in a box. This has to feel bound and claustrophobic and black and white. And I saw this panning shot, and I saw this idea of placing Irene in a momentarily voyeuristic space where she's looking at people as opposed to being scrutinized, which she so often is during the rest of the story. And this panning shot where she sees Claire, and also her seeing Claire for the first time and crossing her legs, and I heard the sound effect of the nylons. I mean, it was all these, I mean, I'm citing these details that made it into the movie. I promise you there were an awful lot that didn't make it into the movie, and I erased 13 years of editing and processing. But there was so much that I couldn't hold back. And, you know, you asked me about the process, and I think the fact that I did shut the book and open the laptop also meant that I wasn't really being honest with myself about really wanting to turn it into a film. It just felt something personal and an exercise for me. And I think that gave me complete freedom just to get all of the ideas out and into a script form. I honestly didn't think it would be my first film at that point.
You did not?
No, I did not. I thought I'd be out of my mind.
Do you want to say what that first thought was?
You'd have to be insanely arrogant to decide to make a work of literature that you were in awe of as your first film and make it formally ambitious and in black and white and in 4:3 and about, you know, a very potent subject matter. Like, that is insane. I'm not going to do that. That'll be my fourth or fifth film. But, you know, I grew up and realized that making any film is an act of insane arrogance. So you might as well start off with the most arrogant one you got.
a moment ago, you said that there's a bunch of stuff that's in the film, but a bunch of stuff that didn't quite make it in the film. And one of the things that's kind of lingering in the background, as it were, is Chicago and the first part of the novel. What kinds of editorial decisions did you have to make about Chicago relative to New York, New York relative to Chicago? Not in the sense of kind of competing metropolises, but the kind of backstory, personal backstory to Irene and Claire, and what Chicago does to inform your viewers about how they're thinking about class, about sensuality, about sexuality, and about gender, that's very local to Chicago.
It was, this was a tough call for me, because I understood the historical context of Chicago. I understood why it works so well in the novel. But the sort of touchstone of the adaptation for me was something that I felt in the spirit of the novel, which was economy, simplicity, because it allows for the complexity. There had to be space to let it sing. And I think in film terms, to switch locations, to hold two cities, would have diffused some of that tension. I mean, maybe not if I'd had an enormous budget. I didn't. This was a super scrappy indie that was brought together from lots of different sources. And, you know, it was 7 years of people telling me, we'll give you more money if you make it in color, or we'll give you more money if you change these aspects of the story. And me saying, no, I'll make it for less than it. It has to be this way. But so, yes, yeah, some of it's practical. Like, there's no way I could have gone to Chicago. But another side is just streamlining the narrative into a sort of very snapshot, tense place. And, you know, everyone thinks of New York during the 20s, and they think, instantly they think jazz age, they think loud, they think bustly, they think big cityscapes. And again, for me, it was this idea of simplicity and economy. I actually wanted to make something that was counterintuitively very quiet, very pared down, very claustrophobic. You know, I didn't really want to see the big perspective. I couldn't afford the big perspective, but I didn't actually want to see it. I wanted to see this woman's perspective, Irene's perspective of a city that is narrow and cloying. She sees the same bit of street, so you only get one angle of that bit of street that she walks again and again. There's a repetition, there's a monotony there. You only see the world as she sees it, in the way that a lot of New Yorkers see it. It's only very fancy people that live in high rises that get to see the whole city. Most of the time, you're just seeing a tiny bit of street and the four walls of your apartment. So there is, so that sort of hot housing the action into one location was partially to do with that.
Yeah, I mean, I love this idea too of the kind of the economy of that, those acts of viewing, those acts of kind of being as characters in the film. Viewing is such an important part of how you have crafted your art as a director, but viewing is also very central to these characters. The look, the gaze, moments of staring. And a moment ago, you just used this phrase, these narrow perspectives. And I'm thinking the way in which these corridors of intimacy or created between Irene and Claire. And if you could talk about how you crafted, you know, on the one hand, as you pointed out, only the very wealthy usually get to be on high and look down. In fact, that's the opening scene in the novel version. Right? Mm. She's at the Drake or at the Drayton around the corner here, and she's looking down. But your technique here and your practice, and I think a real deep investment and not simply seeing things on the ground, so to speak, but allowing us to see what Irene sees, which is so unusual to have an audience see what a Black woman sees. So trying to think about how to call that or identify this kind of corridor of intimacy or kind of corridor of vision that is filtered through her eyes, that is seen through her perspective rather than someone looking at her. Rather than just someone looking at her.
Yeah. Well, it's informed by someone looking at her. She's kind of unlocked by someone looking at her on some level, you know. You know, it was always the fundamental problem. Maybe problem is a little harsh. Challenge. I would like to put a more positive spin on it. a challenge of the book that it is not in the first person, but it feels that way because you're granted this enormous access to the interiority of Irene, who's having a nervous breakdown. I mean, is the only way to put it. I mean, Nella Larsen sort of telegraphs that it's about this one character who's hiding her racial identity. But the truth is, and the kind of big sort of turn of the book, is that it's actually about the one who's not hiding her racial identity, but is arguably hiding everything else about herself. You know, she's so bound up in her own social performance and her own ideas of what it is to do the right thing and to be the right kind of woman, the right kind of wife, the right kind of mother, the right kind of member of the black community, the right kind. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but there's a sense that she's so bound by that, those ideas, that she doesn't actually know who she is or what she wants. And the one who is performing something is actually free to be completely herself on some level. So for me, it was like, how do you slowly let the audience understand that the person whose eyes you are seeing the world through is crumbling and unreliable? Because even if you could give her a monologue that sort of revealed herself, her truth, it wouldn't be true because she inside is lies anyway. She's not being honest with herself about the effect that this woman has on her, everything that it unlocks in her. So it became about exactly what you're saying, sort of playing with that sense of perspective. So, I mean, a lot of the times it's unnoticeable, but you're watching the movie through her eyes, and then I started playing with the moments where things literally go out of focus. Or, for example, when she's coming down the stairs and she sees them standing very close together in the reflection of a mirror, and then she comes around the corner and it's just a sort of trick of whatever, and actually they're standing much further apart. So even if you, and there were some liberties that I took that were very specific in this area, like it was very important to me to keep all the possibilities alive. So even 2 minutes before the very end of the movie, if you are someone in the audience, of which I'm sure there are some, there are always some, who are absolutely convinced that he's had an affair, if you're listening closely, right at the end, he whispers in her ear, "I love you." And that was just to play for those people of the audience that are convinced, just so that you have to leave the cinema thinking, oh, maybe actually it wasn't. Maybe it was the other thing. You know, and also, but also to go back to your point about the gaze and the perspective, it's like, it's also oral. You know, the sound design was incredibly important to me because it was another way to access her interiority. You know, it's not realistic, it's expressionistic. And she hears things all the time that don't make any sense. Like, you know, the bird tweets and the traffic noises are very deliberate. When Claire crosses her legs and Irene sees that, the sound of the stockings is very loud. I mean, she's sitting a long way away. There's no way she would hear that sound as loudly as she does. But this sort of force you into her, the things that hit her on a sensual level.
It just occurred to me a moment ago when you were speaking about perspective that even though the frontispiece of the novel is about this very fraught, intimate, and complicated relationship between two women, which would make just for a great story unto itself. But the way you've been talking about Irene almost makes this like a character study of her. You said she is a woman who's breaking down. She is disallowed a monologue. But what we do have are lots of interior thoughts that are afforded to us by Nella Larsen. Mm. I wonder how you negotiated those inside voices, if you will.
It became a sort of visual language. There are some sort of, you know, Claire, for example, talks about, she explicitly says, "I'm not safe." And whether she means, "I'm not safe because I'll do anything I want to get what I want," or whether she means, "I'm literally not safe because I carry around this seed of danger with me everywhere I go." It's kind of both. But sort of by the by, Irene is the one in the movie anyway who is literally unsafe, as in she drops stuff. You know, she's dangerous. and that's sort of a way of cluing up this idea that she's quietly a powder keg. There are, you know, also the use of mirrors. There are these moments where you do sort of glimpse at maybe something else. And there's a lot of that. There are also something that I loved playing with was holding the two of them in one shot for as much as possible. and shooting it from angles where you could be aware of one of them looking at the other in private without the other one knowing. And also seeing the effect of Claire. Like, she's this sort of, you know, she's this kind of charisma of sunshine that kind of, when it's shining on you, you can see Irene being like, oh, I'm beautiful. It's all okay. And then when it goes away, she's lost again. And those sort of private moments of seeing that, when Claire's not looking at her and seeing Irene have that experience, was very important as well. Obviously, that relies heavily on the brilliance of these actors, both of which are extraordinary.
So we'd love to follow up a little bit more about Ruth Negga and Tessa Thompson in a moment. I want to just separate out, if I can, for the audience, both here and online, like, your role as a kind of screenwriter and then your role as director.
Mm.
You've already been kind of intimating some of the choices, artistic choices you made with the mirrors and adding on phrases like, I love you at the very end here. But as a director, when you are behind the camera and you're trying to capture shots or translate a certain kind of vision in a novel and in a story that depends upon acts of seeing and acts of misreading that which is before your very eyes. One of the most explosive scenes and one of the most complicated scenes is when John Belew comes in the afternoon during their tea party and can't quite see what's in front of him, even though he's already engaged in a whole kind of racial discourse and has deployed this kind of moniker, this racial epithet as a term of endearment. And he thinks he has a sense. He thinks he has this kind of awareness that he could identify an African-American or a black person if they were in his midst. And yet there are three of them who are quote unquote legally black, but and culturally black, but they, he can't quite see them. How did you work at that? And the character, John Belew, is played by Alexander Skarsgård, is an amazing actor. But how did you work through the kind of the practice and politics of seeing but also not seeing?
Marcy Rogers, our costume designer, who's extraordinary and from Chicago, incidentally, I remember she read the script and I took a meeting with her and she was talking about that scene in the meeting and she was like, white man sees what he wants to see. I was like, yeah. I mean, it's about context. There's a deliberate oppressive whiteness to that scene, literally in the way we shot it. Like, the walls are white, everyone's wearing white, there's a huge amount of light coming in the side window. And I think what I was thinking was to sort of highlight that very idea. Like, in this context, in this room, in this white world, this man holds all the power, and he's the one that gets to name what he sees. He can say what he sees. He can see what he wants to see in that context, because he holds that power. And that was a more interesting place to go from, rather than, I don't know, it's also the black and white affords me this, right? And it was very important to me that while he's seeing what he wants to see, the audience is only seeing them as black. And to do that, I had to cast people who, two women who an audience have a fixed idea of their racial identity as black, because then I have something, then the film has something from which to destabilize that fixed idea from and to call into question the kind of swirling nature of all this stuff, you know. And I think it's a more provocative option than creating a space with two actors that we know to look very white or to be white. Which I think would be a different kind of feeling. I don't think you would have that fear.
I mean, how did you work around that opportunity, or how did you turn that obstacle into an opportunity? So Ruth Negga is an amazing actress and is in a film from 2016 called Loving, about the Jerome Loving case, and who obviously had to visibly and perceptibly play a character who was black, and Tessa Thompson was most recently in Sylvia's Love, where she is the daughter of an African American record shop owner. Mm-hmm. So, how did you, like? You're also working in the kind of a moment right now where we have very strong black female actors.
And
you had to, what's the phrase here?
I don't know where you're going with this.
neutralize or destabilize their blackness in a way to make them pass as, to make them as characters who could pass.
Well, it's because the movie's in black and white. There is a heightened reality that is abstracted. You know, there's not, it doesn't look like the, I mean, it always struck me that the most interesting way to make a movie about colorism was to take all the color out of it. It renders it metaphorical. And also, the ultimate sort of joke, if you will, is that all of these categories are kind of a nonsense, including the idea that black and white film is black and white, because black and white film is gray. It's 1,000 shades of gray.
So speaking of black and white film, there and the gray or the gray zone, this kind of unclear, ambiguous space of interaction that is highly fraught between, especially between Irene and Claire. I wonder if you could say for our audiences just a little bit more about the kind of counterpart characters. So John Belew and Brian. Brian is Irene's husband, who is a black professional and is a doctor, and is at pains to convince his wife that as a black family, they'd be better off leaving the US and going to Brazil. And of course, John has made his money in speculation in somewhere in South America. So that both of the husbands have some kind of affinity with some places not the US.
Yeah, I think Brian's character was always played by the incredible Andre Holland. I mean, I always found his character really interesting, because I had conversations with everybody in the cast, everybody in the crew, actually, that were, you know, along the lines of everything about this production, about this movie that we're making has to be passing. Like, every character is passing on some level. Even the movie itself is passing. It has its own cinematic performance, being black and white, being sort of cinematically beautiful in that way. It has its own kind of dialogue with cinema and that thing. So, you know, this went to the grips, the cinematography department, the costume department. The costumes, you know, some of them are actually 1950s costumes. You know, it went to the production design. It's not really the 1920s, but it isn't not either. And when it came to speaking to Andre about this, it was really interesting, because I was like, well, how is this man passing, and how do you hold all the ideas that you hold? How do you look from the perspective of Irene, like someone who is capable of having an affair, but also at times from the perspective of the audience as someone who is desperately in love with his wife but just can't access her, and is actually making a lot of sense by saying, I want to get out of this place. I mean, I found it really refreshing that a character written in 1929, that a black character in that context would be saying, actually, this place is a hellscape, let's get out of it. And I wanted to lean into that idea, but also Andre and I spoke a lot about the fact that the conversations that they have, him and Irene, are sadly every bit as relevant now as they were in 1929. I mean, parents of black children are still having the discussion about how to do this. Do you protect them? Do you keep them in a bubble of protection, or do you tell them how it's going to be and protect them that way? And that's the conversation they're having.
There's so much about this film in terms of its cinematography, in terms of how you're thinking about the intimacy of landscapes as they're walking through personal streets that have brownstones and the like, that make this feel really different than other film adaptations about the Roaring Twenties, the most conspicuous of which, of course, is The Great Gatsby, which has been done several times over. But I wonder if you could say to us, or talk a little bit about how this is not simply, or how this is different than simply kind of a black version of the kind of decadence of the jazz age, and why the kind of complexities of this relationship are different than the ones that Jay Gatsby and Nick Carraway kind of suffered through.
Well, for a start, it centers on the emotional lives of two black women. That's
a very big start.
That in itself is a very big start. It's a very big difference. I mean, I don't know. It's a sort of, I mean, what I find personally extraordinary about the book, aside from my sort of personal connection to it that unlocked so much for me, is that she transcends the specificity of race fairly quickly and actually brings into relief this idea of that I think any one of us struggle with at any given time, of how do you negotiate your identity? How do you negotiate the tension between the story that you're telling yourself about yourself and the one that society is putting on you? And this, of course, is, you know, we have words like intersectionality to describe how all these things intersect and are affected by the larger systems that these particular women are operating under. But it's, I think that is the discourse that she's really getting at. Like, what do you think you believe? And how does that not match up with what you want?
I've been really generous over the course of the conversation to say, to give us snippets about your artistic practices. And I just want to ask you a question specifically about being a director and the kinds of decisions that you have to make regarding a kind of 4-3 aspect ratio or black and white, as you talked about in terms of the the gray zone effect, your casting choices. Like, how did you have the confidence, or what was it? Did you say crazy or insane? It has to be an insane project.
I said all of those.
All
things,
of those things. Yeah. In the kind of schizophrenia of making, a film,
yeah.
Your first one at that, like, how did you make decisions about each one of these aspects? So the film ratio, black and white, the casting decisions. It's from what I read before. It seems that both Nega and Thompson had signed on quite early.
Yeah, they stuck with it for, well, Tessa for 2 years, and Ruth stuck with it for 3 before I got all the funding. Yeah, it wasn't easy. You're asking me how I came up with all that stuff.
Yeah, how did you? Just give all your secrets away. This is a moment of revelation.
I'm not sure that I have a good answer. I've written other screenplays. I thought about making other films, but I didn't have such clarity of idea about how to make the other ones as I did this one. And I don't entirely understand it. There was just always one way to make this film for me. I'm sure there are many other ways to adapt this book, and you know, will be many other versions of it, but this was my version of it, and there was only this version.
Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, we will chat with Deborah Nelson Link, author of the forthcoming illustrated biography, Pauli Murray, Shouting for the Rights of All People. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.